This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Yawen Lay, professor of sociology at Harvard University. We're discussing her recently published book, The Gilded Cage, Technology, Development, and State Capitalism in China. The Gilded Cage examines the economic transformations in China over the past two decades. China has started to shift from an export-oriented industrial economy to one focused on developing technology companies in the vein of Silicon Valley. This rapid change has been both nurtured and constrained by China's authoritarian government. Economic transformations inevitably lead to social reconfigurations. China's economic strategy has implications for everyday Chinese citizens in the neglected manufacturing sectors and the newly upheld tech sectors. There are also tremendous implications for the global economy, as China charts a course of development that both competes with and serves as a potential model for other nations. Yawen, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you so much for the introduction, Caitlin. Thank you for having me.
Of course. You know, this was, I think, an extraordinarily fascinating book. I feel like many people, like it's very hard and difficult to understand what's going on in China's economy at a broad scale. I try and read the news and keep up, but I really needed a guide. And I think that this book really was a very helpful guide for helping paint a broader picture and giving some background on what's going on with China's economic transformation. But before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
So I am a sociologist. I was trained in both law and sociology. So before I came to the US, I practiced law in Taiwan. And at one point I decided to come to the US and I had a law degree, GSD from Yale Law School. But in my second year at law school, I decided to pursue a sociology PhD at Michigan at the same time. So basically I wrote two dissertations, one in law, one in sociology. So the PhD training was more on intellectual property rights. But then I fell in love with sociology, and now I identify myself as a sociologist and don't really have a strong like law person or legal scholar identity.
And for that particular background, it's obviously a very interesting background in terms of your depth of skills. I'm wondering, how it is that through that course of study you then eventually came around to writing this book. Where did the idea first germinate for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as I mentioned, I had two degrees and I wrote two doctoral dissertations. So my law school dissertation at Yale was about the copycat mobile phone industry in China. So at one point of time, so I think you heard of like Huawei and other brand name Chinese mobile phone. But at one point of time in the early 2000s, they had some kind of copycat mobile phone industry. And then I was interested in the like intellectual property related issues. But then I switched to my PhD dissertation, which is about how the internet has impacted the political development in China. So these are totally two unrelated, not that related projects. One is more on intellectual property rights, the other is on political sociology, especially if you are familiar with Habermas' idea of the public sphere. So I was really fascinated by the internet, the development of the internet in China when I was doing my PhD studying sociology. But after I finished my first book based on my PhD dissertation, I was thinking about what kind of project I would like to pursue for my second book, because we need to have two books to get tenure. and then I was really around that time. So in the beginning, when the internet was developed in China, people were very excited by the political potential. And then gradually you saw the Chinese government actually began to kind of like be able to find a way to really contain their public sphere mediated by the internet. And but then at the same time, you also kind of observe the rapid rise of the internet related business on the in China. So the rise of this kind of big tech companies. And there was a point in time, I really, every time when I went to China, it's between 2008 to 2015, I observed like a rapid economic transformation. It just seems to me that everyone was kind of fascinated by the possibility brought by this new technology, especially the information technology, the kind of potential it can improve everyone's life. But at the same time, I also observed things that didn't look that rosy. For example, around the same time, I saw the great transformation of Chinese economy. For example, I went to some places in China and I found the local government really wanted to upgrade the economy, and they want to have everything that's cutting edge. And they want to actually replace, for example, human workers with robots, and they hate what they consider as obsolete industry or business. They didn't like people or citizens without like high level of human capital. So people were so excited in China, but I feel ambivalent about this development because I know the consequences of deindustrialization in other parts of the world, like in the US. Some people benefit from technology oriented development, but some people suffer from the process. So, and then when I began the project, that's what was the time. So that's around like 20. So because of my previous study on the cell phone sector, so I had been doing research in Guangdong province. That's where China's economic development began. And they are the kind of, if you want to observe industrial upgrading and then move to a tech-oriented industry, that's the most important province to observe. So because of my continuous kind of fieldwork based on my GSD dissertation in that province, and then looking at the development of the like tech sector, I was really fascinated. But I'm also thinking about the different dimension who actually benefited and who actually didn't benefit that much. So this kind of thinking motivated my study. And I want to know, especially because I began to do my GSD dissertation after the 2008 financial crisis, just immediately after. So I was able to kind of observe the rapid transformation in China. So I'm wondering how we should understand, how I should make sense of the rapid transformation, that kind of like a very zealous pursuit of technology-oriented development. So that's why, and also a lot of book on China don't really focus on the post-2008 financial crisis period. So that's what motivated my book.
When you look at the roots of today's transformation to more tech-oriented economy, where do you see the ideas germinating from? You know, at what point was China's either government leaders or people in the tech sector saying that China needs to begin to start this transition, and how did that first begin?
So I think there has been a long standing of wanting to use science and technology to rejuvenate China. So they have been having this kind of thinking and ideology. I actually show this in the book since the late 19th century, basically the Qing dynasty, because it's partly because of the imperialism, the Western imperialism, their interaction, the Chinese Empire's interaction with the Western powers. And but then so there has always been this kind of thinking, and like science and democracy was also were very important thinking in the ROC period, Republic of China, so before the Communist Revolution. And this thinking continued to exist. But in my book, I think I argue that only in the mid-2000s, so that's before the financial crisis, a local government in China, and also to some extent, central government began to kind of see the limitation of their developmental model based on export-oriented and labor-intensive manufacturing. So they were kind of they were concerned about the problem of scarcity, especially the scarcity of land, because there is a limited supply of land. And sometimes when I tell people who actually don't have a lot of knowledge about China, they will tell me, okay, China is so huge, right? China is a country with a huge, huge territory. Why there is a problem of the scarcity of land? You always have land. But then so China has a very uneven economic development. So the economic development began from coastal China, just few provinces. That's the richest province in China. And then and different provinces are different. And it's this kind of rich provinces in coastal China that began to experience the problem of lacking enough land. And in the past, when investors go to China, for example, a lot of Hong Kong-based manufacturers or a lot of Taiwanese manufacturers, for example, one of the best example is Foxconn. That's a manufacturer that produce a lot of Apple related products. They assemble things together. So when these people, this company went to China, basically they work with a local government, and local government basically gave them a large piece of land, and then and provide cheap labor, right? And but then the local government realized at that time they actually don't really have, or they didn't have enough land to provide investor. There are more and more. There were still a lot of people, a lot of business who still wanted to invest in coastal China, but then the cities, especially in the municipality cities in this province, just realized they don't have land, enough land, and at the same time, because the real estate market also began to grow very rapidly, so and all of the land either belonged to the government or belong to the villages. So if you allocate more land to manufacturing, that means that and the government can profit from land selling. So that means that the government would actually make less money. So they just think they had to actually kind of reorganize their economy in another way that don't require so much land. And then so then technology like became a solution, because if you think about like having some kind of like internet-based company, they don't really require that much land. I mean, land compared with like manufacturers. So when we talk about like labor-intensive manufacturing, we often forget that it actually it's kind of land-extensive manufacturing. So today, if you go to like you go to Detroit, right? Even in the U.S., or you go to Phoenix, right? There are like a Taiwanese semiconductor company is building a fab in Phoenix, and you can see how large the land is. So they really require a lot of land. So the mid 2000 is the period in which they didn't they the local governments in China see, okay, we just don't have enough land to continue the existing model. And then and the situation was worsened by the 2008 financial crisis, because when the export the markets in the US and EU and in Europe were hit severely by the financial crisis, then they just saw that they have to have something else that can rely more on domestic consumption and that didn't really need so much land.
So yeah, you mentioned the 2008 global financial crisis. I imagine in the U.S. of course, and in the West, it impacted incomes and, of course, lowered the demand, demand in the West for manufactured goods. How did China adapt to this new economic challenge?
So they did. They were really faced by this ch challenge. So the major, the main measure taken by the government was to come up with a huge stimulus package. I forgot a specific number, and they just the government had to put a lot of money into the financial system. And then they so that actually went to the infra. A lot of money went to the real estate sector, and also the tech sector, and also the infrastructure building. So that's the way they had to deal with the financial crisis. And but then this kind of strategy and also actually led to a lot of unintended consequences because so. I think there are some major transformations after the financial crisis. So the first is, as I mentioned, that's the focus of my book is the rise of the internet sector, and then you can also see the continuing growth of the real estate sector and that collapsed today, yeah. And also really the huge investment in infrastructure. That's the way they boost their GDP. And but then the problem today is that so they spend so much money, a lot of investments, but then the return has been declining over time. And it's really one problem of China's developmental model is that it's so investment oriented, rely on investment. So you they don't really know about whether the return is good or not. And it's just not sustainable. And but then I think one very important development is the rise of the internet sector because it's the I mean the proportion of the digital economy to the entire GDP has grown from very low around 20 something around 18 or 15 perhaps in around 2010. I forgot the exact number, but then to almost 40% in 2022. So the digital related economy became really a very important pillar of China's economy. And you can imagine that when this sector was cracked down on by the Chinese government, how, I mean, what kind of impact it has on the Chinese economy.
So when it comes to the Chinese government, how exactly do they involve themselves? At what level of the the economic at what level of just the business process of building a company, do they get involved? Is it at the ground level typically, or is it more so they come in once a company has already reached a certain stature?
Yeah, so basically both China's economic development relates to a very large extent on local governments. So after China's economic reform, many local government officials behave as if they are a CEO of a company because their performance evaluation is linked to or was linked to directly linked to the GDP growth rate. So they really try very hard to attract investor and to decide who has what kind of land and in which prices. And they can decide utility prices and give people different rates. So they played, like local government official played a very central role in deciding who got what. And then so after the mid 2000 in coastal China, so this local government official, when they began to really decide to pursue a more technology-driven developmental model, as I mentioned in my book, they began to crack down on this kind of obsolete, like small traditional manufacturers, because they think these businesses were not worthy, were not worthy, and they shouldn't deserve the land and the resources, bank loan. So they would decide like which businesses, what kind of business to crack down. So basically, they can enforce the law. They usually initiate a lot of legal enforcement, law enforcement campaign in a very, very arbitrary way and based on a lot of excuses like environmental regulation or safety regulation. There could be a lot of different kind of regulation, but the legal enforcement is very selective. When they wanted to promote some kind of industry or businesses, they don't really implement the law. But then when they decided that these are not the sectors, the businesses they want to promote, they began to enforce law very severely, very very strict way. So that's how, and they can also decide, like local governments also decide, like bank, the allocation of bank credits, right? So for example, if you are considered as a high-tech company, then they allocate you to some kind of science park zone with very good price. Like you have land and you also have better prices in terms of utility. You get a lot of subsidy. So these are the instruments in which they can influence the local economy. And also they it's not only about the kind of resources for a business actor. It's also about resources for workers, ordinary citizens, because in China they have this household registration system, or you can consider that as some kind of local citizenship. So not everyone has a citizenship in a specific locality. For example, think about the situation in the US. If you move from one state like Massachusetts to New York, you have to get a local citizenship in New York, like if this is according to Chinese institution. Otherwise, it's very likely that your children cannot have access to a local public school. So there is this kind of like uneven citizenship. So and local government can decide who deserves local citizenship. So they come up with some kind of application like point system, and they can decide. In my book, I kind of documented the kind of measures, metrics in which some rich local governments allocate, decide who get what. So basically, if you have very good education, you are a property owner and you have high income, and if you're and if you are a patent owner, if you can invent things, and if you are not too old, like if you are below 40 years old, and these things give you more points. So and you can imagine that. So basically, they classify people based on those people's perceived contribution to a more technology-oriented development. So they link things together. So the local governments, and in this way, they just don't want to include, right, people who cannot contribute to like techno development, right? If they were like factory workers, like they provide these worker provide like low skill work, then those people are not welcome. But today, if you are an engineer in a high tech company, then you can get more points, and your children are more likely to be included in the local, like the public school system. So this is also one way that they can allocate resources. And then the central government is also very powerful. They kind of came up with more central level policy, industrial policy. They began to develop a lot of industrial policy things around 2006. And that's what the US government has, I think, for me, I think it's a bit imitation. So the US has also begun to develop a lot of industrial policy. That was kind of some similar, based on some similar thinking. So these are the way the both central government and also the central government can decide, can kind of give a kind of a more overarching guidance, right? They give clear indication about what kind of industry they want to prioritize, then the local governments would actually follow that and came up with their own specific metric to incentivize a different kind of business actors.
So you mentioned that for manufacturing workers, they're not necessarily, as considered as welcome. But what happens to manufacturing workers? What ends up being the kind of life experience? What's happened? What do they end up doing with their lives?
So this problem has existed in China for a long time, this kind of institutional discrimination. So based on local citizenship, because a lot of workers, they are from villages, like rural areas. And then, so usually for this kind of manufacturer, so they leave. So you might heard of a term called left behind children. And because they're of their institution, parents cannot bring their children to the place where they work because children don't have a lot of opportunity to go to public school. And private school sometimes is tend to be more expensive, and sometimes the quality is also not very good. And at some point of time, some local governments in China even cracked down on private school for migrant workers. So these people, these worker can only leave their children behind. And when they become old, when they save more money, they go back to their villages. So you can see how family sacrifice. So that creates a lot of family problem because of the separation of parents and also and the kids. But then, in terms of the development, the transformation, in the manufacturing sector. So I also want to mention that there have been changes in different generations of factory workers. So China began its economic reform in late 1970s, and you can imagine like there are different generations. It's already decades, different generations of workers. So in the past, when China was poor, people actually feel proud to be a factory worker. But then today, young people don't want to become a factory worker anymore because life is honestly very boring and could be miserable in factories. The work conditions are not the best. So when I was understanding the impact of some local government's initiative to replace workers with robots, and I found that in fact a lot of young workers don't really care about this because they don't want to be like factory workers in the long term, and they just want to do something else. Many of them want to become like small business owners, but then it's kind of there is a gap between aspiration and the reality. Sometimes I also know, for example, several female factory worker, they hate factory life. But they just simply couldn't find a better job in the service sector, and they kind of went back and forth between like service sector and the factories. And for people with children, they kind of began to really like appreciate the stability of kind of factory job because usually the labor protection in the service sector is really not good. And when I was doing the interview, because there are young people really don't like the factory job. And when I was doing field work, many of my interviewees actually left their jobs in the factory and moved to China's platform economy. They became like food delivery workers. And that's actually related to the rise of China's internet sector. So I think from the government's perspective, they also think, like the central governments in China also think, kind of this kind of transformation toward a more tech-oriented economy might not kind of undermine like factory kind of low-skill workers so much because first, these people don't want to become factory, don't want to remain as a factory worker anymore, and then they want to have more interesting thing. And second, they expected that the kind of platform economy, the internet sector, can accommodate it and absorb this kind of like surplus labor. So that's the calculation.
You look at Daniel Bell's 1973 book, The Coming of the Post-Industrial Society. This is a book that, where Daniel Bell it looks at the economic transformations that are going on in America, the process of deindustrialization, the rise of the service sector. And you kind of demonstrate how a lot of what Daniel Bell is predicting about the future of America has kind of come true in China. Can you talk about Daniel Bell's predictions for his book and what you see about how his ideas about what would occur in America maybe maps a little bit better onto present day China?
I think Daniel Bell's work is super interesting, and I think it's unfortunate that because I don't know because of the a lot of people's perception of him because of his cultural view, and also because of the politics in the late 60s. And he was considered as kind of very culturally conservative, perhaps by a lot of intellectuals today. So I don't find people, a lot of people are reading his book anymore. But I do find his book very important. And a lot of things we are talking about today, like algorithm, big data, and computing, he was talking about this kind of thing in his book. He was trying to think about the future. But I think he didn't really predict. I wouldn't say that he predicted things like correctly, but then I think, I mean, his predictions for me are not important, but I think he really lay out kind of he kind of pre-saw very important social transformations because of technology change and the pursuit of a technological driven development. I think that kind of thinking is very important. And in a lot of, for example, like discipline, for example, in sociology and also in political science, sometimes we tend to overlap this kind of material dimension of change. I'm not talking about like, I'm not making a generalizable argument, but I think in some situation, we tend to kind of neglect this kind of aspect. And I think his description, he didn't really expect what's going to happen in the US because in his time, that was the period of the welfare state, right? So in which like still the New Deal order. So that's before the rise of the neoliberalism. So that's a very, very interesting period, the 60s and also the 70s. Then you saw the transformation in the UK and also in the US. So basically, he kind of thought that the government would become very important, would play a very important role in planning the economic development based on technology. So he saw that. And so, but that didn't, that actually is important because I think still in the US, I mean, and he, actually what he understand the, about the role of the government is very similar to what a lot of scholars study about the we call developmental states in the world. The most classical examples are like the Japanese government, the Taiwanese government, the Korean government, right? They plan things and then try to kind of upgrade the economy based on technology. And the governments play a very important role. But he emphasized the role of the government. But in the US, I think the government still played a very important role, for example, in terms of the development of the internet, right? The investment of the military, the Ministry of Defense. And then, but then you can see like the dwindle of the withering of the state in the US. People didn't like the idea of the big state anymore, right? With the rise of the neoliberalism. So I think he didn't really expect the rise of the neoliberalism, at least at the discursive level. So, and also I think what he didn't see, but then his understanding of the role of the government really kind of map very well in the Chinese context because the Chinese government really really take that kind of leadership in terms of guiding the development of economic and social development based on technology. So, and the second thing about Daniel Bell's book is the kind of stratification, like a social transformation as an outcome of technology-driven development, like new kind of stratification in society. So he wrote about the development of professional class, people who actually have the cultural, have the human capital to understand technology. So he saw the rise of this kind of people and also the rise of service sector. And I think one thing he didn't really predict and he kind of regretted when he was old was the increasing inequality in the US. So he didn't expect that the technology kind of driven development would lead to so a high level of inequality in the US. He thought that technology kind of would contribute to like a high level of abundance, and everyone actually, benefits from that kind of development. So, so no one is left behind. So he didn't really think about, he didn't really write about like the industrialization in his book. So his picture was like, is very, very rosy. And, but then we see that in that aspect, his prediction, he didn't really see, he kind of, he was kind of very, very surprised and very, he feel very bad about the consequences of the industrialization in the US and the increasing level of inequality. So I think he wrote an essay perhaps around 2000, and in which he kind of reflected on his own thinking in the past. And then I think this in terms of the inequality, I think what happened in China is very similar to what happened in the US, because now I think US and China are both one of the most unequal countries in the world, even though China has a socialism, has socialism as its official a principle written in constitution.
Yeah, when it's really, really interesting, and I'm sure that, you know, like you said, like part of the problems that Daniel Bell didn't foresee neoliberalism was still kind of in that Keynesian frame of we're just right around the corner from the the society where we won't need to work as many hours and people can enjoy their lives. And of course, you know, that hasn't quite happened. But
that's very shocking.
And I, you know, one can understand why someone, why he would have thought that considering how much growth and development occurred in the 20th century. But, you know, I'm also really interested in, you know, what it's like for the tech elite in China. You know, what is their perception of the economic shifts? Are they, you know, through the roof with excitement, or is there, you know, maybe a sense of concern about what's been going on as well?
So they were super, super excited. I think they only began to concern after or around the time when the Chinese government began to crack down on the tech sector in 2020. So there was a golden age for them to make money. So these entrepreneurs, many of them were from like not like extraordinary. They don't have they didn't have extraordinary family background, but they were able to get rich. And there is a really high level of upward mobility in the tech sector. So people were really full of hope. And they saw, they were also very inspired by the development of Silicon Valley. So they saw that the entrepreneurs in China saw this kind of Silicon Valley, the American tech companies as some of their kind of models. And, but it's also very interesting that, in fact, even though China was a latecomer in terms of industrial development, so in the late 90s, I think you are young, but then like before you were born, there was a dot-com boom, right? And at that time, so in the late 90s, so several U.S. Tech companies were founded at that time, and then at the same time, there were like a lot of very big China's tech company like Alibaba, Tencent were founded around the same time. And so I think the future, I think, and also they really have deep connection with the US. They were inspired by the US, the Silicon Valley, and they got money from the US. So they got a lot of capital from the US, like the market, the financial, the capital market. So it's really kind of the two like tech sectors, the tech sector in the two countries are really, were really, really connected. And in fact, I began my book by writing about President Clinton's visit in China in 1998. That was the first time an American president visited China after the 1989 Tiananmen massacre. And so, and in that, and they had, and when Clinton, when President Clinton went to China, he went to Shanghai Library, and then he was talking to all kinds of leaders, like tech leaders and other kind of like scholars in China. They had a panel discussion, and the topic they were discussing were about like technology and cooperation between China and the U.S. And both sides thought that the internet related sector is where the two countries can cooperate, and they can actually mutually benefit it. And then Clinton also said that, okay, like by working with China, so that's in his speech. So around that time, so the trip was for preparation for US-China's bilateral trade agreements and China's subsequent accession to the WTO, that's in 2001. So at that time, so Clinton think by working with China, that benefit the US and US workers, don't, their life can be improved. So you can see the thinking at that time. So that was the heyday of the neoliberalism. That's before the financial the financial crisis. So you can see how it worked. And then today, you think about who you, I mean, I think the Biden administration and the Trump, they were very similar, they are actually very similar in terms of their policy toward China and their trade policy. And both Trump and Biden administration are talking about like how American workers, the working class, suffer from the trade arrangement. But then if you look at Clinton's speech at that time, so the thinking was that would benefit the working class in the US. So it's so I think in my book it's like it's a really things happening in my book occurred in the heyday of the neoliberalism, and then in the end the crackdown of the tech sector in China also like happen in a context where like the neoliberalism decline, and we are entering into a new stage of globalization. Yeah.
Your book, it's almost, you know, even though you're writing on such recent topics and recent occurrences, it's almost a history in the sense that it kind of ends by looking at this, how whatever the, you know, this period of time that led to this, the rise of the tech sector, in China is, you know, there's changes afoot. Do you think that that this crackdown is it going to lead to broader shifts, or, you know, what do you sort of see as the kind of the present day circumstances and challenges for China when it comes to transitioning their economy and reining in the tech sector?
Yeah, so I think the crackdown is really unfortunate. But I do believe that there need to be some kind of regulation, like both in the tech sector, both in the U.S. and in China, and in many parts of the world. And the U.S., I think, really because of the lobbies, the regulation on the tech sector, I think for me was not adequate. But then I think people have different kind of thinking today. But I think in China, I think the problem is really that I think there need to be some kind of regulation, but then they actually don't do this kind of regulation through the framework of the rule of law. So they do this kind of regulation through a very arbitrary legal system. And that's bad for everyone. Maybe good for the government because the government can decide what they want. They are not constrained. But it's really unfortunate because no one really can challenge the decision made by the government. For example, all of these tech companies in China, like major tech company like Alibaba, and they receive fine, like a punishment from the Chinese government. But no one can sue the Chinese government, or suing the government has no meaning. It's not meaningful. So you see that after the government punished them, their response is, "I appreciate the government's guidance." That's it. And so I think, I mean, without this kind of rule of law, people don't have trust in the system, don't have confidence, and that really gives a very bad signal. And very few people would want to invest in China, like domestic. I mean, even regardless, they are like domestic investors or foreign investors, and then that's very bad. I think institutionally, that's not good for development. I mean, further development. I mean, they want to pursue, like, they want to have, the government has trying to kind of promote a foreign invest, kind of to attract foreign investors. But then you can see there has been a capital flight. And so institutionally, that's very bad. And also, the economy really rely on China's tech sector, this kind of internet-related sector, because they really play a lot of role in the GDP. And so that's bad. And this company really, they really kind of profit. They really kind of operate quite well and provide a lot of opportunity for different kind of social groups, like employment opportunity. So that's bad for, that's kind of you, the government is killing one of the pillar of the economy. So now, and but then the government, but they have to, I think the reason why they crack down of the tech sector is that the government feel threatened by the tech sectors, because so usually in China they have something called like national champions. So basically national champion control, they are usually state-owned enterprises. They control very important infrastructure in China, like electricity, railway, bank. But then the internet, so people who study the like the communication, they kind of, or platform, they argue that this kind of platform or internet company are really, they really kind of control infrastructure, like the digital infrastructure, right? The cloud system and like in China, the online payment. And I think for the Chinese government, it's threatening because these are private companies in the end. And then if the government doesn't really, the government doesn't have direct control, they are not state-owned companies. And the government also kind of worry about the financial like problems, stability, I mean, brought by this company, because these companies, a lot of tech companies actually lend money to a lot of internet users. So they also exist like banks in some way. So they're different from the US counterparts. So they have to, they crack down on them and they feel threatened by them. Also, these companies have data. And they go IPO, they went IPO in the US. So it's really unclear that the US government like want to have data from them on what this company would do. And the Chinese government feels insecure about this. So, but then really they destroy, they kind of try to regulate the sector, but they regulate in a way that kind of that really make the sector very, very bad, unstable. And then, and no one can know what the government is going to do, no predictability. So that's bad for businesses. And at the same time, the government now think these internet related companies are not really high tech. So in my book, I talk about like they have this kind, they want to select birds, like new birds. But I think now the calculation is that these internet companies are not really deserving new birds, because their technologies are soft. They are not like a semiconductor or energy. So they have kind of, they kind of have their new target. They, for example, they will continue to invest in kind of semiconductor industry and industry that's kind of, they have their, developed their new thinking on who are deserving and what kind of industry are deserving, what are not. But the problem is that, so it's very difficult for the newly emerging sector to replace the internet sector in terms of their role in economic development, in GDP, and their role in providing employment. For example, a lot of people are crazy about the electric cars, the new energy sectors in China. But if you look at the numbers, they only account for 9% of China's GDP. And the in digital related economy accounts for 40%, and the real estate sector account for around related sector account for 30%. So even they have this kind of small new engines, but then the extent to which they can really support the economy is not that large.
Is there any, attempt at all to try and, shift to a more consumer-oriented economy, or is that too unwieldy, hard to control?
I think they really want to kind of shift to a more consumer-oriented economy. And in fact, the internet related, the internet, the previous model, like the internet, the e business, right? They contribute to that. But then, it's, there is a limitation, because in China, because they don't like the US, they have very kind of like different from the US, but in some ways similar to the US in terms of the like a very weak welfare state. So they need to actually save money and for like unpredictable things. And also really if you look at the GDP per capita or the average income, it's really not high. There is a huge difference between like China and also the US in terms of like GDP per capita. So I think there is a difficulty in terms of like relying on like a more consumer-driven economy, even though the Chinese government wanted to do that. And now the real estate sector has been having so many problems, and many Chinese people already put so much money in a real estate sector because for Chinese, they don't have a lot of channels to investment. So usually for them, the real estate sector is one of the very few ways in which they can invest. And usually the family, they collect a lot of money. They just put the money in the real estate sector. And now the housing prices have went down so much, and they still have to pay the loan. The housing prices are crazy, like in major Chinese cities, it's really crazy. And so if you think about like the fact that the housing prices are depreciating, and then you still have to pay the loan, and the future is unpredictable, and you have to take care of yourself because of the weakness of the welfare state. And then I think this kind of uncertainty, I mean, wouldn't be good for developing a consumer kind of or a consumption oriented economy.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and you know, certainly, I think you've given myself and lots of people many things to pay attention to look at, to consider. Yawen, thank you so much for being guest on the New Books Network. It was great to talk to you about The Gilded Cage. Truly a really fascinating book where you cover so many different topics and do a great job of blending you know, social theory and sociology with you know, kind of contemporary political and economic analysis. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you for having me.